Welcome to the podcast Benzo Tired. I'm your host, Neftel Benesty, and I'm Dutch. Join me on my journey into the world of benzodiazepines, withdrawal, bind, and more. Disclaimer, always consult your physician for medical advice. This is episode 20, Holly Hartman, and today it's June 9th, 2023. On June 9th, 2023, I spoke to Holly Hartman, a filmmaker and within the benzo community best known for her documentary, As Prescribed. In this episode, Holly shares her personal experience with benzodiazepines. Be advised, this episode may be perceived triggering for some listeners. Holly, welcome to Benzo Tired.
Thank you so much for having me, Neftel. I've been looking forward to doing this podcast with you.
Me too. Now, the benzo community may know you from your film As Prescribed, but in this episode, I really want to touch on your personal story considering benzodiazepines. So could you tell the audience when you got a benzodiazepine and what for?
Yeah, you know, I can honestly say that the story I tell most of the time is the time I was given clonazepam for ME/CFS, and we didn't call it that at the time. It was long ago. It was in the 90s. We called it chronic fatigue syndrome in the United States and myalgic encephalomyelitis in the UK, and SIFIDS. I was part of an organization, the SIFIDS Association of America, and we were trying to spread awareness. But I can actually go back years earlier, and you know, I had been exposed to benzodiazepines, like even in college. I remember sometimes before tests, I just go, oh, I want to be able to sleep. And the doctor at the health center would distribute Dalmane, for example. And I know you know that one.
Yeah, and that was my benzo.
I remember taking it and thinking, wow, yeah, I'm sleeping, but I don't like the way it makes me feel the next day. So I said, well, I'll do this sometimes when I feel as though I need to sleep the night before. And I have, of course, learned since then that we don't really have to operate like that. We make sleep more important than it is. Again, you know, took it probably maybe half a dozen times my senior year in college, and then just didn't. No information given about what a benzodiazepine was. But around that time, Karen Ann Quinlan, a young woman who was, she took Valium, and maybe there was alcohol too, and she went into a coma. And around that time, and I remember thinking, oh God, this Valium, that's a bad drug. I never knew that I was taking something that was related my senior year. And she just was in a vegetative state for, I believe, years. So I always had this funny feeling, like this negative feeling about Valium being a drug I would never want to take. And then, was the book Dancing as Fast as I Can. There was a book that came out, I think it was Dancing as Fast as I Can, and there was a lot of publicity about that. So in my mind, I wasn't going to be a benzodiazepine taker. I wouldn't have, you know, taken anything regularly along those lines. Mm-hmm. Well, at a certain point, when I moved to New York City, I was having panic attacks, and I went to my new GP and said, you know, sometimes, you know, I was getting some commercial work at the time, and it's like, oh, I would go to these auditions, and it's just, I don't even know why I'm doing it anymore because I can't stand having panic attacks. And he said, you know, everybody on Broadway takes, because he treated a lot of actors, they all take beta blockers. And he said, you don't want to do that all the time. That's not healthy. He said, but you know, there's Xanax is harmless. You know, you take it.
Harmless. Okay.
Yes. Oh, this is another time I was fortunate. So he gave me a prescription for Xanax. And he had actually said to me when we used to have those paper prescriptions, he said, as he handed it to me, I'll never forget. He said, you know, this is such a good drug that I would just like to go off to an island in the Pacific and lay back and take a Xanax. He said, that's a nice vacation.
He
did say that to me.
Wow.
And he was sort of half joking. And I was like, ha, ha, ha. And he said, and these are really helping my wife. Oh, it's
my God.
awful.
Oh
And
my
so
God.
I tried taking the Xanax as prescribed, and I didn't do well with them. I hated the way it made me feel. And I was fortunate because, and I didn't know it was related to Valium. I just thought, well, he may love this, but I don't. So that was my experience. Oh, also, oh, I remember, oh, there was another incident, since we're really going to dive into this. At a certain point, you know, I had been a lifelong insomniac, and every once in a while it would bother me. And I remember when I was in Los Angeles, living in Los Angeles, there was a period of time where my gynecologist, when I said, oh, I'm having trouble sleeping, and he did give me Dalmane. And then what happened is I was lucky again, because that same doctor said at one point, he said, you know, I'm reading reports about Dalmane and it's not good. He said, do you think you'd be happy enough to stop taking it? He said, you'd probably be dealing with insomnia again, but I think you'd be better off. And I said, I'll take the insomnia. I don't want to take something that's, you know, if you're reading that it's dangerous, I don't want to take it. So I didn't. So that was the end of that.
Wow, okay.
Now, why don't we have more doctors like that, right?
Yeah, definitely.
He was a wonderful doctor. And it's part of the reason I always felt safe talking to my gynecologist about these matters.
Right.
I'd had such a good one in Los Angeles. All right, so then jump to when this other doctor, this GP, gave me Xanax and I hated it. So that was the end of that. And then, probably the second or third year, second, maybe 2 years after I moved to New York, it was when I started making short films. I was just working, 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 exhausting myself. And for whatever reason, I developed ME/CFS.
But you were tired. You were tired chronically.
I was exhausted, but it wasn't like, if you know much about chronic fatigue syndrome, which I still can't help calling it that because I called it that for so many years, or ME. It's the kind of ex it's less about exhaustion, about being tired, and it is a certain kind of exhaustion, extreme exhaustion from having this overactive everything systems, immune, nervous, everything's just going, 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 going. And that's how a doctor was able to convince me to take clonazepam, because she said, this is going to slow your system down. There's a celebrated doctor in North Carolina, Dr. Paul Chaney, who came up with this protocol for ME/CFS, and in great part it uses clonazepam, Klonopin. And so that time I was told to take 2 milligrams per day, and I was so sick with that that I was like, I'm going to do whatever my doctor says. So I didn't that I bought
One question. Were you aware at the time that you got prescribed this clonazepam that it was related to Dalmane and Valium?
absolutely not. And here's the funny thing, it had an insert. I read the insert and it was a little concerning, and I actually went to the doctor, the prescribing doctor, and I said, you know, I'm a little concerned because it's talking about these effects, like side effects, like that are not good. And she said, no, don't worry about it. That's just what they put to protect themselves from lawsuits. You know, it's just a disclaimer of sorts, you know. She said, this is, and I was given the old, you know, this is, you can take this for the rest of your life. It's perfectly safe.
Wow. How
Yeah.
did the 2 milligrams of clonazepam make you feel when you first took it?
Well, I was so sick with the ME/CFS that I didn't really notice. I was really sick with it, and it was, but as I was, so I never knew. It took years for me to understand. At a certain point, I thought, oh, because she also gave me Ambien. The Ambien, so you take 2 milligrams. This was a protocol: 2 milligrams of clonazepam, and then an Ambien. I think a 15-milligram Ambien, and then at a certain point, because I connected. You know, at a certain point, I realized, oh, this is helping me with sort of nervous issues. Like I had sometimes a fear of flying. And it's like, oh, yeah, the clonazepam helps with that. The Klonopin helps with that. And then I got to the point where I thought, well, there's really no need to take an Ambien. I mean, I'll sort of cut to the future, which is I did recover from chronic fatigue syndrome. I mean, I did lots of things to recover from that. And, so in the years after, when I'd start having what I realize now were tolerance issues, I was always told, well, this is just a relapse of chronic fatigue syndrome, or SFIDS. And it took many years, because I kept taking, now, at that point, I wasn't taking the Ambien, and I had decided, well, I'm feeling better. I'm not going to do the chronic fatigue syndrome protocol. I'll just kind of take the Klonopin as needed.
Okay, so that was your plan. And then what happens?
That's what I did for many years. And I'd go weeks without taking it. My doctor, I was in Massachusetts at a certain point, and my doctor was in New York, so she'd have to send these prescriptions that were in triplicate. And I remember when that happened, I said, why is this a controlled substance now? And she said, well, that's because in New York, you know, people do abuse these drugs. And so there is a criminal aspect to this. And that's why that was her excuse for why it was a controlled substance. Just for the abusers. And it's like, well, you don't abuse them. You don't even take them as much as I prescribe them. And so, but she would send these triplicate forms and I wouldn't even fill them, you know, half the time. And I can look back now and go like, you think, well, maybe that was worse. I was always intolerant. And
but thinking, you didn't know. You could have not known.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I had no idea because I wasn't taking it every day. And that was where I was really not understanding. It was like, how could something I wasn't taking every day be my issue? Because, and especially I was, you know, we do the chasing after the symptoms thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had all kinds of health issues, of course. Basically, now we know everything that falls under the umbrella of BIND. And doctors, I've already said, they would say it's a relapse. And then it became things like metals toxicity, you know, testing for lead and mercury. Oh, yes, yes, that's what your issue is. And, you know, just, and then finally, I had, I just wasn't being diagnosed as having anything exotic anymore. You know, it was what happened is I decided at one point, I just didn't want to be taking a medication I didn't truly understand anymore. I said, I don't even know why I'm taking it. I did start to feel as though there's a kind of like a strange little dependency happening, even though I'm not taking it every day, but I still didn't connect it to these crazy symptoms I was experiencing. So I just thought, yeah, why not? Just stop taking it.
And so, how long were you on the clonazepam when you decided?
Heaven. That would have been probably about 17 years.
Whoa.
I recall. It was many years. And, because it took me close to a decade to recover from ME/CFS. So just imagine, through most of those years, I was taking 2 milligrams per day. It was only when I started believing, because I was getting better, that I was starting to take it less. And I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel anything that I would have connected to not taking it, if that makes any sense, or cutting down, because I cut down and then I didn't take it. So the way a lot of people do, you take it some days, you take it, you don't take it others, and you don't understand what the hell is going on.
Right. Yeah.
So 4 days after I stopped, as I noted when I had taken my last one and I had taken it for sleep, I thought I was going to lose my mind. I said, what's going on with me? I think I better go to the emergency room. And then I was like, wait a minute. I haven't taken the clonazepam in 4 days. So I Googled, and I'm telling you, I could hardly type. it was really difficult to even.
I've been there, so I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just went to Wikipedia. No, I put in Google stopping clonopin and Wikipedia came up. And so much of the information that I had needed for years was there in a few clear paragraphs.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. And then I ran into my bathroom. I opened up the medicine cabinet and I took a milligram of the blue clonopin. I always liked the color, you know, it was also like the pretty blue clonazepam pill. And it's like, oh my heavens. And because at one point, like the half milligram, I believe, was orange and the milligram was blue. And I didn't really think, I should not be laughing. It's a horror show. I remember saying, you know, there's really not a difference between the half milligram and the milligram, and I like the color blue, so why not just do the 1 milligrams? Seriously.
Right. Well, I think it's, you know, I can laugh about my almost dying and everything, so I think that's a good sign of healing and processing all of the trauma that is happening and all the information and kind of like the rug being pulled under you when you find out that you've been poisoned basically for so many years and you didn't know, and everything all at once. You did ask, like, and you were concerned, but no one intervened. And I totally get it. Yeah. So you take a milligram or half a milligram of this clonazepam.
One milligram.
And then what do you do?
Well, it did calm me down immediately. And I was like, okay, yeah, this is what it is. That's for sure. And so I spent the rest of the day into the evening going, for example, I found benzo.org UK or benzouk.org. And I found one of the really important things I found that day was an essay that Geraldine Burns had written. She had a platform that was associated with a Yahoo group that she had organized, I think it was the first of its kind, that was a real group of people in it, ended up going into the thousands. I mean, so I saw this Geraldine Burns that was in Massachusetts. She had written about driving with children in the car and just panicking and not understanding what was going on, and then realizing sort of after the fact that, oh, what was going on was the benzodiazepine, that she was in extreme tolerance. And that was one of the things I was experiencing. I had terrible problems driving. And I never made the connection, never, because I thought the clonopin still worked.
So, but just for the understanding of the audience, when you went online, did you find the ASHA manual, or wasn't it online at
the
time?
I did. I found it the first day.
Oh, right. And did you reach out to Geraldine and her?
No, I was too sick. I was too sick to reach out to anybody in that way. I found it on the benzo.org.uk site. Or is it benzo.uk? Benzo.org.uk?
Yeah, I think it's that one. Yeah.
Okay. And I downloaded it. I just had a digital copy that was available at the time. And I emailed my doctor right away. You know, I was pouring through the manual and going, this is what I need to do. I need to start doing this immediately. And I had a very nice doctor. I mean, she didn't know about this, but she was cooperative. And I sent her the manual and I said, okay, thank you for prescribing me the clonopin, but I'm going to stop taking it. I'm going to stop. This is not a healthy medication. And she was, she listened and she agreed to help me taper off immediately. And so we got going. And this is the part I think so many of us realize with the Ashton manual, that at least my doctor, and I was counting on her because I could barely comprehend anything. I was sick. And the way she interpreted the ASHA manual, she interpreted it very literally. And so she did originally have me start cutting too quickly. So she just went, I think, to the tapering guide and not really reading about all the subtleties and what to look for and when to not be cutting, that sort of thing.
Right, but so, I have a question. If you take the Ashton manual literally, she recommends that you cross over to Valium. Nowadays, we know that's not always...
Yes, that was the plan originally. And it was going to get going, and then I was going to do the crossover. I never did do the crossover because at a certain point, then I found Benzo Buddies. And Benzo Buddies was a big breakthrough because then I was finding other people who were having all these conversations about what was working for them and not. And I was, I spent time on Benzo Buddies obsessively. And wow, what a gift that was. Just so much information on that platform.
Yep.
And so many people helping each other. But the thing I couldn't handle about Benzo Buddies was the negativity. So I didn't engage much. Because I just couldn't handle negativity at the time. Once I was tapering, I was just so fragile. But it was finally, it was on Benzo Buddies probably at what point? When did I did go to my doctor and say, thank you, but this is not working for me. And it was kind of bad because she had said, well, I have another patient who I think would benefit from stopping a benzodiazepine. So I'm going to see if she's willing. So she actually recommended to a patient that she taper off. But the other patient was able to do the quick, you know, like some people can follow the obvious on the Ashton manual and do the crossover and they're fine and they do it
right
pretty quickly and they're great. That was my doctor's other patient. I was more complicated.
Right. What were some of your symptoms when you were so sick?
Oh, Godfrey, everything. It was just everything about being alive wasn't working. And it was such a horrible existential feeling. It was so, it's a very frightening existential experience because there's no light. I remember not being able to see colors properly and I knew it. And it was so disheartening and just like, how long am I going to have to live life like this? Pain. I think so many of us feel terrible pain. And I would have unexplained pain in different places. Depersonalization. My depersonalization was not as bad as a lot of people. I had extreme derealization, though. And this sort of akathisia I have, I feel so bad when people say, oh, that's not really akathisia. I didn't have the pacing kind. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, be in my skin for the kind of akathisia I had, where you're digging your fingernails into your skin, trying to force you're with your child and trying to force yourself not to move and draw attention to yourself. I used to have to go to like class presentations.
Wait, you did all of that while you were in withdrawal?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
And I would just, I remember just having like marks in my thighs from digging in. And oh God, it is hard to relive this. I usually don't. I usually talk about it in terms of as prescribed and it's sort of lighter fare, you know?
It's okay. It's okay. It is the darkest. Okay.
Of course. I'm sorry, Naftal. I want to talk about this. I really do. Because it's so difficult what people are going through. And the more we talk about it and validate each other and care about each other, we are already making a difference and we're going to make bigger differences.
We will.
We can be thankful that things are already happening. But yes, so there was that. And I have this other thing. And some, I can actually talk about some symptoms that were almost funny, but just the certain, but most of it wasn't funny at all.
Yeah, I think for me, when people ask me, because if you're not familiar with benzo withdrawal, it's impossible to explain it to someone else. But I felt like I was in another parallel universe where it was just darkness, hell, torture.
Yes, yes. Torture, definitely.
Torture, 24/7 torture.
Absolutely. And that's when you also have that feeling of needing to escape yourself. Like which, you know, that sort of akathisia feeling. Did you have that too?
I did. Yes,
yeah.
I did.
So we also are living like in this torturous parallel universe that's just nonstop and haunts us in our, you know, I can't say in our dreams, in our sort of almost like our awake nightmares, because we never really sleep.
Yep.
Yeah. And and crazy headaches, and of course the neurological problems. I remember I just couldn't read, and I remember like I still had to like run my house and trying to write checks to pay bills, and how many times I would have to write a check, and I wouldn't let anybody see me writing because I had so much trouble. I had so much trouble doing anything, and I just hiding it all from my daughter. I didn't want her to know. And you know, I look back and realize something that was fortunate was that it was a period of time where she was so into gymnastics, and she would just, and I had it set up so that because I could not do the drive, my driving issues, I would just have rolling panic attacks. I don't know if other people can relate to this, but I could only take right-hand turns, and I would just, you know, taking a left-hand turn was just beyond what I could do. And I still have driving issues. You know, you have a legacy, or a lot of us do, and I still have a legacy of that, for example, because it went on for so long, and for so long I didn't understand what it was. But my daughter was I was able to find babysitters to drive her to her gymnastics class. So she'd come on the home on the bus. I'd manage somehow. And, you know, in morning, I liked mornings. I could function for her in the morning and make her good oatmeal and just things she liked. I actually could still make good pancakes. And you know, her obvious needs, you know, because she was going to school all day. Most of the day it was so simple, and then she was running off to gymnastics, and she was happy because she loved gymnastics. And then in the evenings, you know, they were kind of easy. You know, we'd find a television program that we could watch together, for example, and lots of Amazing Race. And I had been working with, on my last film, sort of the Amazing Race camera team helped with my last film. And so that was kind of, so we kept sort of, I was able to keep sort of fun things going. Like we would sort of pretend we were doing the Amazing Race together, that we were going to do that someday. And
so how long did your taper last?
Almost 2 years.
Whoa. Okay. And when, once you got off, did you get protracted, some issues afterwards?
This is where it gets complicated. I was doing fine. Actually, I'd say, and I also had to do a quick taper. It was much easier. I was taking bioidentical hormones. And I know that the progesterone was affecting my GABA receptors to some degree. It wasn't much, so it wasn't a lot, but it was like that last thing, just like, okay, you know, you don't need this stuff. You know, this was the same doctor was like, hey, it just keeps you younger longer. And it's like, sure, I'll do that. But then as I was reading more, I realized, no, this probably isn't a good idea. And I really didn't want to be taking anything. So, and those were just like patches that you put on your skin.
Right.
So even with those, I was like, okay, I'm going to take this seriously. It's still a medication of sorts. So 3 weeks without any sort of incident, I guess I technically tapered off the bioidentical hormones. And then by the end of the year, I was feeling so good. I was ready. I mean, I maybe was feeling 100% better, certainly 90. But at that time, I remember thinking, hey, am I 100% better? Because one of the big things that happened was that I actually was able to get past my tinnitus by the end of my taper.
You mean it disappeared, or you?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
Okay.
But
that's great.
But then guess what happens? And the tinnitus was horrible. It was like clanging. It wasn't just like a buzz. It was clang, clang, clang. There's so many. Oh, Naftal, you know, there's just like 50 to 100 symptoms that we all deal with. Those of us who really enter the state of bind. So, the end of the year, I went to a holiday party, and the host had fireworks. It was quite fancy, you know. It was really, I didn't know about that. I was feeling the holiday spirit, but then I remember thinking, like, oh, okay, fireworks, great. I love fireworks, but how are we all going to watch them? And we were all herded out onto their small deck. I remember being on the deck and going, this is a lot of people. And I was like, I've got to readjust myself because I'm not feeling too secure just being on the edge of this deck.
Right.
I tried to get over to the steps to walk down, and I caught my heel on, it's, you know, on the step or the edge of the deck, and I went flying onto flagstone.
Oh.
Hit my head.
Oh no.
There was blood. And they just kind of left me. It was like, it's such a funny story. I'm not going to go into like the weird dynamics at the party, but with the host like not really doing anything for a while. I mean, just lying there, and finally somebody's boyfriend said, you know, she probably really needs help.
Medical attention. Yeah.
Yeah. And there was a doctor there, and he took me to his hospital, which was not the closest one. It was a good hospital, and I was taken in immediately. So I had what should have been good care. Well, anyway, it wasn't the best. And, you know, I ended up, they told me I was fine. They did a CT scan or whatever, and didn't do an MRI, which, you know, if you ever have a head injury like that, make sure you get an MRI. So the head injury was kind of dismissed. But what I started noticing immediately was I had tinnitus again. But 3 weeks into, you know, after that accident, I went to the dentist, and he's a dentist I'd been seeing for years, going to for years. And he looked at me and he said, you don't look right. I said, I don't feel right. I don't feel right. I'm told I'm okay. I said, I had this accident. I had flagstone on my head. And he said, oh yeah, you look as though you're dealing with an active head injury. So he made an appointment for me with a really great neurologist in New York City, got me in the next day, and of course discovered that, you know, there was significant injury, and it hadn't been handled well by the other hospital, you know, because I was out in the sort of the woods, you know, I live in a...
And what exactly did they find in terms of injury?
Well, this is why I'm going to... It was interesting. I talked to this neurologist about the background with the benzodiazepine, and he said, you know, you're going to have a tough time because you have this vulnerability from the benzodiazepine injury. And he did call it the injury. And he said, so, you know, I'm going to diagnose you with post-concussion syndrome. He said, but just to understand that it's a combination of the two. It's this accident plus it's just so soon after you finished tapering off the medication. So that's that story.
So, and did you recover from that?
Yes and no. Honestly, I still deal with issues. The tinnitus has never gone away. It's milder. And then I ended up with Graves, which I think was benzodiazepine legacy much more than the concussion. But there's an overlap. There's with all these neural, I ended up more with neurological issues and, you know, the whole HPA axis dysfunction element of this. I rue the day that I fell off that deck because I was really on a healing trajectory, and I know people can fully heal. I never will. And now, you know, add the Lyme in. So, you know, but I don't want to make it sound as though I'm living with terrible regrets. I'm not. I'm really not.
Well, you made a film for the benzo harmed community. So that is something after all that you've been through. So thank you for that. In terms of, we're not going to touch too much on the film, but if you would want to, because you've seen so much and you've done so much research by now and you've spoken to so many people, And you've been in withdrawal yourself. And I always ask my guests at the end of the show, like, what advice would you give people currently listening in withdrawal?
To find support. And if you can't find it in your family or your close community, you know, geographic community, there's so much wonderful support online, Benzo Buddies, some of the Facebook groups. But if people start getting negative, keep your distance, move away. And there are more people supporting, more people going through bind than ever. And that's a good thing. Unfortunately, there are more people being diagnosed because we're realizing how widespread it is.
Right.
And I'd also mention that for true healing, and this is, maybe not everybody will agree with me on this, but I do think diet is key, because our gastrointestinal systems take a real hit with, you know, benzodiazepines. It's one of their targets.
Yep.
And there are certain dietary changes that I think are key to healing. And maybe a rule of thumb is gluten-free, dairy-free, processed sugar-free. I might be forgetting one other. I feel those.
Maybe red meat or something. Maybe.
What, I don't know. What did you say?
Red meat, perhaps.
No, because as a matter of fact, if it's grass-fed, stay away from regular supermarket meats. But if you can get grass-fed, different story. Because some people do very well on a paleo diet or the GAPS diet, ketogenic diet. So not everybody is the same. I do better with some of those either wild fish or grass-fed protein, meat, beef, and lamb. I don't eat it a lot, but I do find sometimes it can be helpful. The getting rid of sugar, that's huge. As a matter of fact, for a while, some people should really not be eating a lot of fruit. I think sometimes maybe that's why the ketogenic diet works so well for people, because there are fruit limitations. But yeah, look at diet and find one of these recommended diets that works for you, because we are all different. And like, for example, the whole controversy about supplements, I was able to take supplements throughout my entire taper. There are so many people who can't go near a supplement.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And like, for example, for a while in my taper, magnesium just set me off terribly. And that it is at a certain point in my taper toward the end, I tried magnesium again, and it was very helpful again. So it's not just that we're all different. We're all changing, as even within our own systems, our
definitely. And that's why it's so complicated. And that's why we can't really give, like, there's no magic bullet to any of this. And everyone is so different, and everyone has their own kind of timeline. I'm super kindled, you know, so everyone has their own it's fine. I'm alive. I'm sleeping. I'm happy.
Yeah.
I'm doing well.
That helps a lot, doesn't it? Oh, you know, and another thing, you know, I don't know. I think this is another one of those issues that people aren't going to necessarily agree on, but I like the idea that there are researchers who are looking for other methods to help people through the difficult, another medication, for example, that might actually be safe to take while people are tapering. Because I know, for example, trazodone helped me. At a certain point, I said to my doctor, I'm not going to make it. I am not going to make it if I don't have some sort of reprieve. I said, I took trazodone for 3 weeks. It helped me. And then I have never taken it again, never been tempted to. There is a scientist who's at the University of Pittsburgh that I spoke to not so long ago, and she understands how difficult the withdrawal experience is for people. And she and her team are trying to find something that could help people through these difficulties, just to ease the torture a little bit. And I think that's a good thing. And who knows, maybe there's no pharmaceutical that will ever help us. But if there is, I think this group has good intentions and good science, and let's see what happens.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's hope. So for the audience, Holly and I decided to do a second episode somewhere in the future where we really touch on As Prescribed, the film. Before I let you go, Holly, a question. Where can people find you, your film? Maybe people can donate something or pitch in or do anything. Are there any websites you would want to say?
Sure. Well, our website is asprescribedfilm.com. And we're going to be migrating to another platform soon enough, so maybe there will be part of the day when it's not operational, but it is now. And, you know, we're gathering funds for our impact campaign. And most of what we're going to be trying to secure going to foundations and people who really have the means, but sometimes those donations that come in help us with things like, for example, the paying somebody to help me with the website, you know, these ongoing things that we always have. It's tax deductible. And for those who care, and you can do it through the asprescribedfilm.com website. And we have two fiscal sponsors, Women Make Movies. They're based in New York, and the Center for Independent Documentary, which is based in Massachusetts. And they support documentaries from all over, and they're both wonderful organizations. And just stay in touch, you know, just on social media. I wish I could be more active. That's a goal, that I can actually spend a little more time having fun on social media, or just connecting with people on social media, just sort of that feel good stuff.
Yeah, I'll be sure to add all the links that I can find in the podcast description episode, so people will be able to click and find you when they listen to our episode. Thank you so much for making the time and sharing your personal story with us.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Naftal.
Thank you. And I'll speak to you soon.
I love your podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the episode. Be well, be safe. Remember, it's not a race, and don't forget to subscribe and rate the show.